Members have 2 minutes to ask to confine themselves within the 45 minutes to questions and contributions. So we urge people to abide by the time allocation. And we asked for National Treasury. Where's the team? Younger, you're going to lead the team, right? We just want you quickly to explain to people, I'm sure they know, but there have been shifts from the previous proposals. But before we start, maybe Comrade Duntua, you want to say a few words. We also hope to meet next Wednesday to finish the hearing, and then our two committees will work together on, to the extent possible. When we talk of government, in this case, we're talking of National Treasury and the Health Department. So my friend from the Health Department, you can speak whenever there's a block allocated to National Treasury. So you can share the 15 minutes. So I'll leave it to you to decide. It's now 9:20, but you don't say anything. Okay. Shall we move on then? It's 9:40. You've got 15 minutes. Thank you. Yeah, just to explain what's there in the health promotion levy. So it's no more an SBT. It's now an HPL. Not that that distracts you from the content. Not that Treasury thinks because it's now an HPL, those of you opposed to the SBT might be more enamored of it, right? So it's an HPL. That means health promotion levy. Right, shall we go for it, please? Can you explain what is now in the rate and monetary bill on the HPL?
Okay, good morning and thank you, Chair. While they're still busy uploading the presentation, National Treasury, I mean, we followed a consultation process to come to a revised proposal that was contained in the rate bill that was presented in the February budget this year. And then that consultation based process basically was the publication of the draft policy paper, soliciting public comments, processing all of those comments, and also having a stakeholder workshop in November last year, and also in between we're having bilateral meetings with a lot of organizations and stakeholders, and also there was a parliamentary the committee process public hearings in January that looked at that, and then we also considered all of that to come to a revised proposal that was presented in the February budget this year. And as part of that, there's also the netlex process that has been initiated, basically where we presented the policy paper, the draft policy paper at the netlex, and then also after the budget, the process was initiated where we can have further discussion on the policy and the socio-economic impact of it. Okay, so basically in terms of the revision, it takes into account the 144 comments that we received in the parliamentary hearing. And in terms of the design, Chris, can you just go to the next? Basically, in the initial proposal that was in the July draft policy paper, we looked at the scope. The scope hasn't sort of changed much. But the most important thing that changed is basically on the tax base and the tax rate. In the initial July paper...
Sorry, Chairperson. Sorry, Chair. We don't have copies of this presentation.
Again, we just got it now, and the committee section, unfortunately, is printing it at the moment.
Okay.
But you can see it on the screen. H, can I suggest, really, we all got iPads, cell phones, computers. It must stop, actually, this printing of documents, in my view. But hopefully we'll raise it to the House Chair. But for now, it's coming to you. Sorry? Right, can we... Okay.
All right. So basically, in terms of the revision, the main focus was on the tax base. The initial proposal was to tax every gram of sugar in the beverage. due to the comments that we received, and after considering those comments, we revised the text base where we provided for a threshold of 4 grams per 100 ml. Basically, what that means is that the first 4 grams in 100 ml will be exempt from the tax, and only from the fifth gram upwards, above 100 milliliter, will be taxed. And also on the tax rate, the initial tax rate that we proposed was 2.29 cents per gram. We revised that downwards to 2.1 cents per gram of sugar. So, in effect, basically the combination of the introduction of the threshold and also the reduction in the tax rate means that the effective tax rate, which was initially proposed at 20%, has been reduced to around 12%. So that's basically the combination of those revisions on the tax base and the tax rate. And with regards to the exemption, in the initial draft paper, 100% fruit juice and vegetable juice and milk products with no added sugar were exempt. We haven't revised that much. Basically, just to say we maintain the revision, but then to say that the inclusion of 100% fruit juice will be considered at a later date, because there are issues around the sort of like the science around the 100% fruit juice and also its contribution, and whether those 100% fruit juice, they have fiber, they don't have fiber, and all of that, and how then do they compare to the other sugar sweetened beverages, because they kind of like the nutritional elements in those 100% fruit juice. So once then we were going to look at the research as it comes, and then that will maybe further be looked at sometime in the future. Just to say that exemption is not a permanent exemption. We will revisit it at a later stage, but for now it is exempt. Yeah, and I think by just a way of example that we have provided there is that we have the rate of 2.1 cents per gram, and then the threshold that I mentioned of 4 grams. Now, when you look at the Coca-Cola beverage there, which has 10.6 grams per 100 ml, then when you apply the threshold of 4 grams, it means in a 1 liter which has 106 grams, 40 grams of that will be exempt, and only 66 grams will be taxable. So now, in terms of the tax due, basically it will be that 66 grams by multiplied by that 2.1 cents per gram is 138. And basically, this is a reduction from the previous calculation that was done. And so in a 330 ml, that means the rate will be about 46 cents. One takes into account the exemption threshold, and also the revised downward rate is about 46 cents. And basically, all of those things, those revisions has taken into account the comments that have come about, and also looking at lowering the effective tax rate. Thank you very much.
Okay. You want to add anything, or anybody else from the health department?
Chair, will there still be an opportunity maybe for later for health to make comments?
Overview. Can we move on now? We're going to monitor you in terms of the stopwatch. We plead with people to stick by the allocated time. So, School of Oral Health Sciences, you've got 15 minutes, right? You weren't here before. Shall we get going? Yeah, I would imagine so. Where are you? Who's next? Priceless essay, where are you? Right, can you start making your way? Who's oral health? Are you two oral health? Also, they're not here. Okay, can Priceless, can you start, please? Also, can we get going, please? Can you help them, Alan? Have we got the written text? Yeah, so we can get start going. Yeah, we have the submission, my friend. Can we start? Because we've got it. It's before you. In the meanwhile, the IT people will have... Oh, there it is. Dr. Molete, is it? Right. Welcome. You want to introduce your team and whoever?
Hello?
You're just alone. Are you here on your own?
Yes, I am.
Okay, fine. Go for it. I'm managing the stopwatch, right? Shall we go for it? Thank you.
All right. Thank you. My name is Mpho Molete. I'm a specialist in community dentistry from the School of Oral Health Sciences at Wits. And I'm also representing the Dental Public Health Special Group of PASA. So I just want to thank you for providing a platform where the voice of oral health can be heard and we can also raise our concerns on the matter of sugar-sweetened beverages. I'll first start by what we know. What we know is that South Africa experiences over 30% of obesity, particularly among women, and hence it's ranked as one of the most obese countries in the African continent, and that's alongside Libya and Egypt. We also know that 7 in 10 of our women suffer from overweight obesity. 3 in 10 of our men suffer from overweight obesity, which is less than women. However, what is more concerning is that children too suffer from conditions of obesity, as 1 in 4 of them are overweight, and that's proportionally high. Now, the harmful contributions of sugar-sweetened beverages have been made clear on obesity and diabetes, as have been echoed widely, and the information has been repeatedly making headlines in media and public platforms. So a lot has been said about the issues concerning diabetes and obesity, but not much has been said about oral health. It's actually been given low priority. And yet oral health is integral to general health and well-being, as poor oral health causes pain, disability, and actually affects the quality of life of individuals. In South Africa, approximately 60% of primary school children have DK, and the NHI white paper actually confirmed by identifying that the greatest need among school learners was oral health care, and that was 66% of the children at the pilot site required oral health care. Studies have also shown that tooth decay is actually associated with school performance, and that's attributed to the discomfort that it causes, the inability to eat, to sleep, to concentrate, and the missed school days as a result of having to visit the dentist for emergency care. Now, how extensive is this problem in our country? In our country, 80% of the tooth decay amongst the children goes untreated. And mainly because, I mean, one of the reasons is that the public oral health sector is unable to cope with the burden of disease because dental treatment costs are generally high wherever you are in the world. And a study that we conducted looking at the delivery of oral health care in a mobile dental unit showed that the average annual cost of screening a child, one child being screened in a mobile dental unit, amounted to 331 rand. And then in terms of providing treatment to that child in a dental mobile unit amounted to 743 rand. So that is quite costly. Now in terms of oral health and sugary drinks, in the oral health literature, it is undisputed that there is a direct link between sugar and dental decay. And that furthermore, sugary drink consumption is also strongly associated with tooth decay. and mainly because sugary drinks have high content of sugar and also have high content of acid because of the phosphoric and citric acids contained in the beverages. Now, this picture over here depicts how a tooth immersed in a soda beverage with over 5 days goes from a process of erosion to complete destruction of the tooth. Now then, in terms of the dental decay pathway, especially concerning sugary foods and concerning sugary beverages, what happens physiologically is that bacterial plaque uses sugary foods and beverages, it metabolizes them, forms acids, which destroys the tooth enamel and causes dental decay. So it's twofold. And then on the other hand, sugary beverages produce acid, which actually causes tooth erosion and leads to dental decay. So in essence, it's twofold. The issues here are the sugar and the acids, which are causing tooth damage. Now, the WHO recommends that no more than 25 grams of sugar intake a day, which is actually approximately equivalent to 6 spoons of teaspoons of sugar. Yet when we look at this picture, we can see that most of the beverages contained on the picture have more than the recommended amount of dose in them. And one needs to also bear in mind that that actually excludes all other forms of sugar that one may be exposed to in one particular day. Tooth erosion is known to occur in an oral environment which is of a pH of less than 4 downwards. And then when we look at the table here, we see all these common drinks, and we can actually see that they're actually below the pH of 4, and which is classified under an extremely erosive environment for the tooth, and that is damaging to the tooth enamel. So what we're basically saying is that alongside other oral health promotional strategies, taxes could contribute to improving oral health. As we've seen, studies out there show that where sugar-sweetened beverages were implemented, it resulted in reduced sugar consumption. And in turn, in oral health, we've seen that a reduction, not only has it reduced sugar consumption, but that it's reduced dental caries incidence and the healthcare expenses associated with treating the condition. Now, if you can remember one thing today, is that one sugary drink per day increases the risk for dental caries by 48% in children and 31% for adults. Now, this is a problem because dental caries is a public health problem in our country. We definitely need a new approach, and so therefore we as oral health professionals that I'm representing today believe that an implementation of sugar sweetened beverage tax, or you call it the health promotion levy, would create an enabling environment for making healthier choices, and it would also assist us in protecting our children from dental caries. Thank you very much.
Dr. Moletta, you didn't use your full time, which we appreciate, so we can engage with your priceless essay. You've got 15 minutes too. Use yourself and get going. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you very much for the opportunity to present on this important issue. My name is Nicholas Stacey. I'm a health economics researcher based at Priceless at the Business School of Public Health. So it's been touched on, but I think the starting point for any discussion on the sugary beverage tax is should be a review of where we are in terms of our obesity and NCD epidemic. So even since the initial hearings, there's been the release of more data, which is increasingly pointing to this being a crisis. And so if we look at the results of the recently released Demographic and Health Survey of 2016, we now have a situation where approximately 50% of adults are obese or overweight. And this has grown relatively dramatically over a period of 10 or 15 years from just over 40%. And it translates into a figure of around 19 million adults who are obese and overweight. I think a bit more scary than that is what we see with children, where between 2005 and 2012, we've seen a similar rise, where the prevalence of obesity and overweight amongst children in 2005 was 15%. It's now jumped to over 23%. This is particularly important because the children who are obese are more likely to be obese adolescents. They're more likely to be obese adults. And they're also, the earlier the diseases associated with obesity present, the more severe the complications are when they do appear. So closely related to obesity in South Africa is diabetes. Statistics South Africa a couple of months ago released a report on causes of death in South Africa. And what we've seen is that, in fact, diabetes is now the largest killer of women. And overall, amongst all adults, the only disease that kills more people than diabetes is tuberculosis. So, you know, the days of saying the NCD problem is down the road, we're past that. It's here today. So we care about this not just because we want people to live long and healthier lives, but also because it impacts our health system and our ability to deliver health care to the population at large. And what we see here on this graph are the number of new diabetes cases that are presenting at public health facilities every month. And in the very small period between 2014 and 2016, we've seen that rise from 5,000 to over 10,000. If we look at the private sector, we also see similarly significant growth in diabetes, where between 2008 and 2013, there's been a 70% increase in the prevalence of diabetes. And this, you know, has significant implications for the premiums that the people in the private sector have to pay. It's also worth noting that these would only be diagnosed cases of diabetes. The International Diabetes Federation estimates that something like 60% of diabetes cases in South Africa are undiagnosed and therefore untreated. So why would we care about sugary beverages? You know, so the starting point is that these drinks are incredibly high in sugar and have no other nutritional value. If you take a can of Coke that has something like 8 or 9 teaspoons of sugar, which is not an amount of sugar that you would put in your tea or coffee or on your cereal, but when it comes pre-packaged to you, people do consume that. So it's not just that the drinks are high in sugar, but it's also the volume with which we in South Africa are consuming them. In 2012, Coke put out a report on consumption of their products internationally. And what you see is that South Africans on average in a year, the average South African would consume something like 260 servings of Coke products. And this is about 3 times what the global average is, and places us within the top 10. So not only are we heavy consumers, but there's also significant growth. So growth is, we will be consuming more in the future. Between 2001 and 2015, we saw something like 50% increase in daily, average daily per capita intake in these beverages, with more growth projected for the next few years. So while we've seen this kind of, you know, development and growth of the obesity epidemic and an increase in prevalence of obesity, increase in diabetes, we've seen this concomitant rise in consumption of these beverages. And that's not, you know, some spurious correlation. If we look at other evidence, it makes sense. So studies from nutrition epidemiology that look at individual level outcomes closely link consumption of sugar, consumption of sugary beverages in particular, to diabetes and weight gain. So the health promotion levy, or you know, the sugar beverage tax, is not a policy that's come out of nowhere. It's been in the National Department of Health strategies for some time, and it's part of a broader wave of interest internationally in how we can use fiscal policies to improve diets. And so in 2016, WHO released a report on the use of fiscal policies, where they reviewed the evidence and made some recommendations. And what they found is that the strongest evidence was for sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, particularly if implemented at high enough rates, but also that if the taxes were levied based on the sugar content of the drinks, they'd have the largest impact. And that's similar to the proposal that Treasury have made. So on the demand side, the pathway by which these taxes would impact, you know, individuals' behaviors via price. So we hear a lot of kind of anecdotal evidence where people say, oh no, the tax won't change behavior. But the reality is, when you look at the relationship between price and sales of these drinks, there's a strong negative relationship. And this is the pathway that would be exploited by the tax. So if we look at this annual data here, just a scatter plot of annual sales of drinks and per liter prices. And in years when the prices have been high, sales have been low. And in years where prices have been low, sales have been high. So this negative relationship, and that's what the tax would seek to exploit. So our research unit has been looking at these issues and what kinds of policies could be implemented for some time now. A few years ago, we undertook a study that estimated the impact of a 20% tax, and what we found were fairly meaningful reductions in the number of obese men and women. Not eliminating obesity, I don't think anybody's claiming that that's what the tax would do, but take a bite out of it. It's of course not the only measure on the table. I think nobody here would say that we would just want to implement the tax. We need a multi-pronged approach with complementary interventions. So if we look at what else could be done, right, something that's been raised are warning labels and the use of front-of-pack labels linked potentially to advertising restrictions. And our colleagues from the Department of Health can correct me, but there are processes underway right now to develop these and to implement these. So those are coming. Another issue that's been raised is the mandating in some way reformulation of these products. And so, you know, we've seen some commitments from industry around this. They're saying they'll make some reductions in sugar. This is concerning, I think, if we just left it at a voluntary level, because, you know, big companies make commitments all the time. The beverage industries have made commitments around marketing, which they haven't followed through on. So if we were to pursue this approach, it would need to be mandatory. There would need to be some kind of evaluation and making sure that it's implemented. But just on the effectiveness of this approach alone, what we've seen is BevSA made a commitment to reduce the sugar content of their drinks by 15%, which by itself, you know, is good, and that's fine. But what we need to do is look forward also. So as I showed before, per capita intake of beverages is going to grow. These companies are incentivized to sell more and more of their products. So if they make marginal reductions, if they take one teaspoon out of a can of Coke today, what's that going to do to our sugar content if in 2 years' time or 3 years' time we're then consuming two or three cans? The small reduction, you know, will be completely offset. Another important kind of policy to implement would be some kind of education campaigns and some kind of media campaigns. And, you know, this is critical. Unfortunately, I think we're all aware that we're in a very tight fiscal space. And so to implement these would be taking resources from other potential other potentially important areas we need to act. However, if we implemented the tax, the use of the revenue would allow for the implementation of meaningful education campaigns. So I think while we talk about the need for a multi-pronged approach without the taxation in it will deny resources and limit the effectiveness of this tax or a set of interventions. Moreover, we're in a crisis and we have the opportunity to act now, which we should pursue. So much of the discussion around the tax has focused around job losses. And, you know, unfortunately, the numbers that have been thrown around with regards to this issue have not been produced through independent and peer-reviewed academic research. They've been produced by consultants who were hired by the industry to look at this issue. And this is reflected in the quality of the analytical work, where we see they've made assumptions that exaggerate the losses of jobs. They've assumed that people who reduce their spending on the drinks just stop spending that money entirely. They assume that money just vanishes from the industry and people don't buy bottled water or other products, which really exaggerates the impact, as well as in other studies making odd assumptions about revenue recycling. I think importantly, all of these studies have ignored the impact of improved health on the economy. So the discussion has focused on, you know, to what extent the implementation of this tax will incur job losses. But I think we also need to consider the implication of what will happen to job losses if we don't implement this tax. And the reality is that NCDs are non-communicable diseases, obesity, diabetes are a significant burden on the economy. In 2009, we had something like 2,000 diabetes-related amputations. We had something like 8,000 diabetes-related blindness. And that's going back, you know, it was 7-8 years now. This problem's only gotten worse. Those would all be people who are no longer able to engage fully in the economy. And this impact on productivity has significant impact, where if we look at some work that was done to estimate the burden, by 2030 we're looking at a reduction in GDP by something like 7%. And, you know, just to emphasize this, you know, there's need for, you know, consultation on this, but the more we consult and the more we delay action, the worse this problem is going to get. So we, a few years ago, looked at what would happen to obesity if we didn't take action. So we estimated what obesity would be by 2017. And we estimated
there would... You're at 3 minutes left, right?
Almost done. We estimated that we would have something like 9 million obese people. The reality is today we have 10 million obese people. So the further we kick this can down the road, the worse the problem is going to be when we ultimately get to trying to address it. So just a few comments on the legislation. So between the July policy paper and the proposal as it is in the draft legislation, what we see is that Treasury have significantly reduced the tax rate per 100 mil on these drinks through the addition of the exemption, but also reducing the marginal rates. And for a drink that has 10 grams of sugar, that's about what most soft drinks are, it works out to a 50% reduction in what the tax rate was. So, you know, Treasury have really come to the table and compromised with the concerns that have been raised about, from industry and others, about the potential economic impact of this. We would still see some kind of health impact in other settings where 10% taxes have been implemented. There have been meaningful reductions in beverages. But it is concessions have been made, and we need to recognize that. So just in closing, we're in the midst of an obesity and non-communicable disease crisis. Consumption of these sugary drinks is linked to these diseases that we are experiencing. And with the implementation of the health promotion levy, we not only have the opportunity to reduce consumption of these drinks, to incentivize the production of healthier options, but also raise revenue to really effectively implement a complementary set of interventions. And I think the benefits of these really need to be considered when we listen to what industry proposals are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Hila. We received, the co-chair and I, a petition of 2,000 signatures. Can Hila provide the copies of the signatures? We don't seem to have it here. We will distribute this. And can you also send us an electronic version of what you gave us this morning? We've got the file here, but if we can just have the electronic version. Right, who's on now, Hila?
Is it Hila or...
No, according to the program, it's Hila, my friend. And then Dr. Saloji, you're on next, right? Okay. I don't know why you're smiling, Dr. Saloji, when I said there's 3 minutes left. I'm just going by the clock. You're a scientist, right? It's not a subjective thing. It's staring me in the face here, the figures. Look, before you carry on, can I just raise something? You know, to the people who are here making submissions, on the one hand, what we wanted to do was set a framework for these hearings and say, we had hearings for 2 days, these are the issues. But then on the other hand, you know, it won't be fair to those who didn't participate in those hearings, so we left it, you know, for you to say whatever you want. But I think it'll be fair to say, Comrade Dundra, it will help the committee if I just gave you 3 or 4 points that the politicians at least, or at least not the majority of politicians at least, and certainly the finance committee members feel, are issues that we would like you to address. The first is that it may be true for me to say that the majority in this committee, in my view, were overwhelmed, but at least impressed with the quality of the academic input. So I think for the majority here, there isn't an issue about the, what's the word, deleterious, is that the right word, or bad consequences of sugar. The challenge we have as politicians, which academics sometimes don't have, is how do we find the balance between that and the position of workers, and also the emerging black, particularly African cane growers. We are trying to strike a balance between that. What I think has helped since the last hearing, colleagues, if Dr. Stacey is accurate, what National Treasury has done is reduced the levy by 50% in effect. So on the side of those opposed to the HPL, you've got to show some goodwill too, it seems to me. We're just facilitating, yeah, obviously the majority was there. You've got to say, okay, you reduce it by half, we'll make some concession. And on the side of the academics, at least in my personal view, and I think the majority of you, you were very, very overwhelmingly convincing. What we would like from you now is some ideas. That's not your job. You're academics, you're scientists, you're not politicians. But you're also South African. Then you know our unemployment crisis. You've got COSATU and PAVO, two very powerful constituencies saying, we can't do this. Secondly, you've got, you know, the ANC concerned to have radical economic transformation and whatever that might mean. But you know, at least one strand of it is to empower the excluded. Now, in this climate, to do something that will snuff out African and black cane growers, emerging ones, will not be easy to manage in a political climate. So I'm just saying to you, it's not your job, my friend. I remember you were very, very good last time, like your colleagues. Brilliant, actually. But as politicians, we have to manage all these things. When I say some of these things, please don't put your hand up and say I don't agree. I'm just saying that is my view and the majority. My job as a chair, and Lindelwa can speak for herself, is to say, address the issues that emerged in the last public hearing. And ideally, we would have liked those of you appearing today to have seen what came out of the last hearing. I'll then let Hila take over. Yeah, Alf? Can you help to
Chairman, I think it is helpful because one of the things that I mean, I think we all convinced now about the health issues. I mean, that we don't need convincing. Perhaps there are some, but speak for myself. What we would be very helpful is if we would be able to be given empirical evidence that a tax is going to have the desired effect. That's where the difficulty lies. Not convincing.
It's a bit unfair to ask a health scientist to do it, but then you are scientists, right? And you can apply that, and you can come back to us. Remember, we are not plunging into any decision-making now. There is another set of hearings, so you've got another week or two. But can other members come in now? Are there things? What I'm worried about, my brother, what I'm worried about is you're going to come here with a very powerful argument that's not necessary. For those of us,
Well, let me speak for myself, because I can't interpret the health committee members. I understand the finance committee members better. So I'll speak for myself. For me, you don't have to convince me. It was world-class, as I told somebody the other day. In fact, it was so impressive, I'd forgotten how good our scientists are. So, for me, you don't need to convince me. What I'd like to know is, what are your ideas on managing the different variables, if that's the word. Now, can members guide this hearing? How can we steer this hearing towards, you can say what you want, it's your call, but helping us to find these balances. Now, I see a hand going up there. Is that Pinky? Yes. And Wilmot.
Chair, I think you also covered me in a big way on what you said. And I remember the presenter who is now coming in. You see, it will be better, especially for those who are now getting a second bite, to say, this is what we presented, and this is how we think going forward are the mitigations that we need to look at. And I know we don't have to put you on the spot, and unfortunately, we're seeing your face for the second time, and we don't expect you to repeat what you said, but to take us somewhere else. And I think, Chair, I fully agree with you to say we should also be able to look at what are the unintended consequences that this may bring to ordinary people, the workers, those things that you also covered. So I'm fully in agreement.
Thank you very much. I mean, the whole case has been made, so it doesn't have to be repeated. The issue for me is whether the tax has the desired behavioral consequences, and what is the evidence you provide for that, other than desktop evidence, that is. Do you have the empirical, have you been running a pilot program to test the behavioral choices that are made? And that's the first question. The second is, it's actually for Treasury, is that I don't see anything but ring fencing here at all. Simply because the commitment has to be for increased expenditure to our health research bodies to run an ongoing real-time analysis over the next 5 to 10 years as to whether the calibration of the policy is going to work or not. And all we have is a commitment on the part of the Health Ministry, but I mean, the MRC needs more money to do that if you do a longitudinal study. So, but that's a question for Treasury, not for you.
You raised that the last time. Anybody else want to speak, but more directed towards our civil society stakeholders. Can I once again say it's not your job? You can do whatever you want to do. You can say whatever you want to say. So, and also you have the opportunity for another 2 weeks to think about the issues. Can I also say, look, the committee system is staggeringly understaffed, okay? Ideally, we'd have liked to have summarized for you a 4-pager. That's what I thought about. But it's just impossible. Finance committee cannot manage, actually. We have excellent people here, world-class like you in some ways, but they can't do more than do what they're doing. So, what I'm suggesting is that you also, before you write to us, maybe you capture, you'll be on the website, all these submissions, and then you can write to us maybe after the second set of submissions, which hopefully will be next Wednesday. Sorry, please.
Chair, my apologies, I'm seeing this for the first time. But for me, a research that has exemptions, it's incomplete. And then what worries me is that they are only selected...
to questions, just to direct the themes.
Oh, okay,
what do you
no,
think?
I think
we'll come to questions.
It
yeah.
is, yeah, it is
yeah.
Incomplete.
Okay.
So it's premature for it to be serving in Parliament.
Okay, fine. All right, we'll raise that issue. So anything else on the structure of the public hearing? I think that's it. You get 10. Okay, Eli, you've got 10 minutes because you were last time.
Thanks for the opportunity again. Obviously, I can't answer all these questions in this moment. It would have been nice to have this feedback beforehand to reflect and realter the talk. So I've come here with the understanding that I'm going to be speaking to some new people in the crowd just to explain some of the science again. But I'll try and allude to some of the issues that you alluded to. So that's why I'm wearing two hats today, advocacy hat and physician, clinician, scientist hat. not to spend too much time and reiterate all of this, you're all familiar with the health effects of sugary drinks on the public. I'll invite you to Google this article. I didn't print it, so safe paper. Have a look at this article to understand the plight of the patients on the ground and the plight of the public health sector in terms of the type of patients we're treating and the health impact. We're talking a lot about jobs, but we don't consider the impact of job losses as a result of complications of these diseases. Diabetes, obesity impacts adversely on jobs. We sit in clinics every day and people are coming to us for disability grants, queues of people, because of the complications of these diseases. And these are people that are now have become economically unviable and dependent on a state. And these factors must be considered in everything. I think there are way more job losses happening because of obesity and diabetes than through a tax that's going to be implemented to help people. I put these pictures out. I'm going to speak with a bit of pictures here. This is the landscape the average South African finds them in. Misinformed people. We have an education crisis. People are not very literate. And we are being nannied into believing that this is the only way to survive in life, to sell these products and consume these products. And this is incorrect. At the end of the day, these are all desire products. And if you look at the science behind desire and satiety in the brain, people are calling these products products of addiction. From very early, these products have been thought to reduce headaches, relieve exhaustion, all sorts of claims. But I put it to you that no scientific evidence exists that these products are beneficial to human beings. The definition of food or nutrient is something that promotes growth and well-being. Right? Food existed on the planet. This is not food. And I mean, if you look at it, it goes way back. So we're familiar with the usual suspects of Ebola, HIV, tuberculosis, and all sorts of various viruses that exist on Earth. And when we think about these, we can see a clear cause-effect relationship because people get sick immediately. But the problem with these kinds of vectors of disease, why we call them non-communicable diseases, is that you don't see the cause-effect relationship. And I put this quote up for a reason. It's something we must really think about. Because the cost of inaction is huge if we don't act now, right? And we've realized this with smoking, with alcohol. Why are we waiting on this one? These products were marketed to children in this way. This would be criminal in today's age. So let's not wait another 10 years before it becomes an issue with our health and of our population. This is what real food looks like. These are food products. This has no benefit to human beings. They simply gratify taste. And I put it to you, it's almost a human rights thing that the average low-income worker, domestic worker, construction worker's staple diet in South Africa has to be a loaf of bread and 2 liters soft drink every day. They're simply eating to fill the stomach temporarily, but they're not getting any nutrition out of it. So this is something that we need to look at and think about very deeply. So the problem from the consumption of these products are those: obesity, type 2 diabetes, my colleague alluded to teeth problems, heart disease, and the impact on growing bones. I'm not going to go through the scientific definitions of this, but we do classify people according
to... We are trying to address this issue. The sex has gone out. Just to alert you, this, as I said before, it started in 1994. So hopefully by 2094, I'm being optimistic.
So the body mass index is simply used to classify how overweight a person is, and the higher your BMI, the higher your risk of cardiovascular disease such as heart attack, stroke, diabetes, etc. These are the obesity numbers, and various people have alluded to the numbers, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. Of note, women's issues are very topical in the media at the moment, and I just want to highlight that women are amongst the most obese in the world in South Africa. And what we're starting to see is that obese women give birth to unhealthy children. So we've got to think future here. Mothers of our nation are unhealthy. The future children of our nation are going to be unhealthy too. Right? There we go, 70% of women in South Africa. So, drinking one sugar-sweetened beverage a day increases your likelihood of being overweight by 27% and a child by 55%. This is all the complications of obesity. So if you've got a product that's contributing so significantly to obesity, and then obesity leads to all of these, you need a super specialist to treat each one of these abnormalities. And in our public health sector at the moment, we are short on super specialists. I had to leave the public health sector for a permanent post because there's a shortage of posts for endocrinologists. We used to be about 7 or 8 at Charlotte Macheke Hospital. There's about 2 or 3 at the moment. We need 1 endocrinologist per 100,000 people in this country, right? We're 73 only, and not all of us are practicing. So think about that for a moment. These are severe diseases that require specialist attention. The epidemic effect of obesity affects longevity, quality of life, productivity. It affects high and middle, low income countries. So we always talk about economics. We've reduced a human being to an economic number on a chart. Yet we don't realize that a healthy human being is the most productive thing on the planet, right? So we're not thinking about it that way. We're just thinking in terms of sales and product. And that's not something we should be doing. If past trends continued, these are in the UK and USA, diabetes, coronary heart disease, cancer, and gain or loss of quality life years, that's the impact. If we can just reduce body mass index by 1%, that's how much less diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and improved quality of life years we would have. 1% body mass index. And that can be done by changes in diet, and even forced changes in diet, especially with products that don't improve your well-being. This is the numbers of diabetics around the world. This is actually much higher now, 420 million, according to the latest figures. The rate of, the mortality from this disease, 76% in Africa. And that's what we see, gangrene, heart disease, stroke. These people are non-productive in society, right? And the support system for these patients is very poor. The risk of cancer with diabetes is higher, most common cancers as well. You can have a look at it from the printout I gave you. And this is the risk of developing diabetes with consuming sugar-sweetened beverages, all increased. There's a direct cause-effect relationship. This is just data out of St. Andrews. I was last week at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, where we worked with some eminent scientists. This is data from 2016. Very new data showing the cause-effect relationship. So we need policy to change behavior patterns here. This is older data from 2009 where Malik already mentioned the relationship between consuming sugar-sweetened beverages and risk of diabetes. These are empty calories. I've already mentioned they don't serve any nutritional purpose whatsoever. And the reason people get addicted to this is once you fill your stomach, all of the sugar gets turned into fat which sits around our waist and is silently causing disease. Unlike TB and Ebola and HIV, you're not seeing the impact until you see complications. These people, after consuming these products, feel full for an hour, but after that get tired, they're more hungry, they continue to consume other junk food to stay satiated, and over time they get metabolic dysfunction, heart disease, stroke, and the cholesterol and blood pressure is happening silently. We've just seen what stats say also. We have high rates of hypertension, and this all contributes. My colleague spoke about teeth health as well. This is also showing that children consuming these products, it affects their long-term health in terms of weight, diabetes, and cognitive dysfunction. We are seeing an education crisis at the moment. I'm seeing it in the university. I teach it, right? These students are consuming these products and not paying attention to the work. We've got to look at the science and predict the future. We've got to act now. Added sugars increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, independent of weight gain in children. Second sugars are now considered secondary smoke.
Sorry, you have about 3 minutes left.
Yeah. Secondary sugars are now considered secondhand smoke. Just as someone smoking next to you, what they blow out affects you, affects children. So if a mother who's breastfeeding and drinks soft drinks with the fructose in it, or while she's pregnant, that sugar is adversely affecting the fetus or the infant that she's breastfeeding. It is considered as a sugar addiction, should be treated as a form of drug abuse. And the World Health Organization recommends limiting sugar intake to 10% of caloric intake, 12 teaspoons or 6 teaspoons a day for additive benefit. I haven't put that slide in. So this is also out of St. Andrews last week where I was, a call to action, all UN member states to develop national policy. This is where policies here in this room can affect physiology at the human level on the street and help us as doctors. When I write a prescription, I expect patients to follow it. This is a prescription, a mass prescription for the nation. That's really what you're looking at here. And the policy and science, we're marrying it together. Who is responsible? Public health authorities, medical associations, and diabetes organizations. That means all of us. This is the latest IDF policy document, which our own organization was involved with. We've just got this last week, Wednesday, in fact. Dedicate part of government's budget, so what we raise in revenue, we can use with civil society groups, promote healthy lifestyles, so all the ancillary stuff after the tax is passed. This is our own guidelines in South Africa. We launched these 2 weeks ago from SEMSA. I just want to highlight the rate of increase of diabetes, 140%. The number of deaths globally from diabetes exceeds the combined mortality from HIV, TB, and malaria. And there are modifiable risk factors driving the diabetes epidemic. So this tax affects one of those modifiable risk factors. And here, in our medical nutrition therapy guideline, a chapter in this book, poor nutrient content, sugar-sweetened beverages, lipid profiles, and obesity inflammation, it messes our bodies up, basically. So this is the whole point here. When I prescribe a drug, almost done, I need to know there's an evidence base that this drug is going to benefit human beings, right? So it goes through trials, there's a policy document, it goes through FDA, it goes through Medicines Control Council, and then I know this drug is safe to use and know the side effect profile. These are products at the end of the day that need to be taxed because at the end of the day they've never been proven to benefit human beings whatsoever. The only benefit has been through false advertising and the economic benefit, right? So if we continue, the future is a continuation of the past modified by the present. If we don't modify the present, the future looks quite dreadful. And I'll appeal to you philosophically because South Africa is a laboratory for a new world waiting to be born. Maybe we can come up with new solutions for farmers in South Africa with promoting healthy agriculture, putting real food on the plates of people. What is the staple food of South Africans across the country, across the various ethnicities? And let's grow farmers in those industries and let's put that food on the plates of people rather than just a product that has come from somewhere else in the world. Water taken up, fresh water which is lacking in this part of the world, in Cape Town itself. You take that water, you take 2 liters of it, you put it in a factory. Half of it gets wasted. You add chemicals to make it taste nice. And then you put it out there for human consumption that adversely affects health. And we want our people to grow in that industry. There's something ethically wrong with that, morally wrong with that. But we can look at other avenues of improving farming, agriculture, industry for black farmers in this country. So I'll conclude with that. Ubuntu is a person through other people. We have to assist our general population through this policy. Start there, then educate, then bring everything else in. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Then is Dr. Saloji with the National Council Against Smoking.
Yeah. Where did I find my slides?
Meanwhile, Dr. Saloji, we've got the text, right?
So we can. No, you don't have the text.
Oh, we don't have it.
It's called a sweet text, the National Council Against Smoking. Okay, let me just, while we're waiting, introduce why the National Council Against Smoking is present as a text in sugar. And firstly, the National Council Against Smoking is a non-profit organization which has been in existence for 40 years.
Oh, hang on. We're trying, if need be, I'll go now. I mean, this is outrageous, really. It's the only venue available. And this carries on, you know, it's half serious actually. It's been intermittent over the last 20 years. And I'm serious about that. So, Alan and Friedman, just find the foreperson or whatever and I'll come and speak with him.
Okay. The National Council Against Smoking is a non-profit organization which was established 40 years ago. Its mission is to promote health promotion through better living and especially helping people to stop smoking. By the way, today is World No Tobacco Day. So let me wish everybody here a smoke-free day. And the theme for World No Tobacco Day this year is especially appropriate to this hearing. It says, tobacco, a threat to development. And the World Health Organization has said that tobacco control is an important part of protecting the health of people, not just the health of people, but reducing poverty and promoting development. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to briefly review why we need a sugar tax, make some comments on the rate of the tax, then talk about the politics behind the tax, and finally say something about the use of the tax. So you've heard endlessly from people about why a sugar-sweetened beverage tax is important, and I'm not going to repeat that. The only thing I'm going to point out is the last point on that slide. The McKinsey Global Institute estimates that the global economic impact from obesity is about $2 trillion, or 2.8% of global GDP. So it has an enormous impact. As far as the rate of the tax is concerned, the National Council Against Smoking is concerned that we are taking an arbitrary approach to this. We're saying, what is the optimal tax? And the optimal tax rate, we believe, should be as high as possible, so that, and with no exceptions. We believe fruit juices should also be taxed. But we think we should go beyond just choosing numbers. We think we need a different system. And the National Department of Health is committed to reducing obesity in South Africa by 10% by 2020. So that's the goal we should set ourselves, and every year we should review the text and say, how far are we to achieving the 10% reduction? If we are not achieving the reduction, we should increase the text more. If we are moving towards the reduction in obesity, then maybe we should pull back on the text. I think it's much more rational to set a target which is measurable, which is transparent, and which provides certainty to the industry. So that's where our belief is, not arbitrary selection of figures and simply say, well, this is the compromise. Compromises don't achieve what our goal is, and our goal is a healthier and a better South Africa, both socially and economically. Now, I want to talk about industry opposition to the tax. And the tobacco industry has a big reputation as the lying king. That reputation has been gained because for 50 years the tobacco industry denied that tobacco caused any disease at all. And in the end, in 2006, the tobacco industry was charged in the United States under the Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act. This was an act that was created to deal with the mafia. And the judge, in summing up her verdict, said, over the course of 50 years, the defendants lied, misrepresented, and deceived the American public to make money with little, if any, regard for individual illness and suffering. All they were interested in was money. Is the sugar industry any different? Well, this is a news article from CBC, and it quotes 1976 industry documents. And the documents ascribe, as shown at the bottom, industry lobbying efforts to sponsor scientific research, silence media reports critical of sugar, and block dietary guidelines to limit sugar consumption. This is an industry which since the early 1970s has been working to make sure that any blame for obesity does not fall on the floors on the sugar industry. And in case you think 1976 was a long time ago, this is an editorial from the British Medical Journal from April this year. Coca-Cola's secret influence on medical and science journalists. And what Coca-Cola did was say, obesity is not a problem of sugar and food. Obesity is a problem of exercise. People don't exercise. That, for me, is irresponsible. And the British Medical Journal points that out. The other thing that we do find both the tobacco industry and the sugar industry do is misuse economics. So here is a newspaper clipping from 1996 when the tobacco bill was before Parliament. And FedHASA, as well as FAHU, the FedHASA is the Federated Hospitality Association, said they were concerned at tobacco bill job losses. And when the parliamentary hearings on the tobacco bill were held, we had sports organizations like the Football Association, the July Handicap, the Surfing People. We had SABC. We had newspapers all saying that if the government banned tobacco advertising, they would all lose revenue and shut down. None of this happened. In fact, instead of job losses, we could see gains in jobs. And this is a study from the University of Cape Town Economics Department which says tobacco curbs may create 50,000 jobs. So where is the truth? Are we going to lose jobs, which intuitively seems right? You close down a factory, people lose jobs. But wait a minute. If people use less tobacco, how will we create jobs? Now, the World Bank, not me, the World Bank has given us an answer. And it says, falling demand for tobacco does not mean a fall in total employment levels. Money once spent on cigarettes would instead be spent on other goods and services generating new jobs. A switch from buying goods that are non-labor intensive, like cigarettes are made by machines in factories by the millions, to labor-intensive ones creates jobs. And if you compare smokers with non-smokers, non-smokers spend more money on education and food, and smokers spend more money on alcohol. If smokers switch their spending patterns to those of non-smokers, we would create jobs in South Africa. That's the reality. There is a strong link between chronic disease and poverty. We talk about jobs, but what about poverty? Well, that is the abiding problem for South Africa, the high levels of poverty in our country. And we will not address it by putting tobacco, alcohol, and sugar down the throats of our people. We need to look at something different. Tobacco use worsens poverty. Now, some of the reasons. Money spent on tobacco means there is less money to spend on other essential foods. In 2008, a quarter of South African households spent about 133 rands a month on tobacco. Just yesterday, the University of Pretoria released data that shows that people who are on social welfare grants are spending between 200 and 300 rands a month buying cigarettes. The same people who are receiving social welfare grants from us are wasting that money on cigarettes, which will harm their health. Spending less on food and education perpetuates intergenerational poverty. Children pay the price for adult smoking. That's the equation we need to remember. Ill health and long-term disability often lead to absenteeism from work and reduced family income. Getting treatment is also costly and increases out-of-pocket expenses at a time when there is no income coming into the factory. In fact, the World Bank takes it further. I'm sorry, I don't think you can see that very clearly. But it says chronic diseases reduce and harm GDP growth. And the reason for that is that over a lifetime, a smoker will earn less money than a non-smoker. Therefore, they'll have less savings. They'll have less money to spend in the economy. What about our industry? A smoker is twice as likely as a non-smoker to be sick and off work. When that smoker is off work, our whole industry, not just one small of it, a whole economy suffers because of lack of productivity. And we know productivity is a major issue in South Africa. It's something we have to address. And the way to address it is to deal with the issues that are causing absenteeism. It is said often, a healthy economy needs a healthy workforce. We will not have a healthy workforce if we continue to push, if NCDs continue to grow. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the benefits of the tax. The tax in itself will be good because it will reduce consumption of sugar. And unfortunately, if I'd heard your comments earlier, I could have brought you definitive proof over the last 50 years of the relationship between price and cigarette consumption in South Africa. It is the most important factor determining the amount of consumption of cigarettes. Clear relationship. When price goes up, consumption goes down. When price goes down, consumption goes up. I'll send it to you. I didn't include it because I didn't have time. But the question I want to ask you is, are we getting value for money on health expenditures in South Africa? And my answer is no. We spend an enormous amount of money on health expenditures, but we don't spend it in the right way. Look at this picture. Think of the population as a triangle. At the bottom of the triangle is the majority of the people who are healthy. Above them are a second group of people who are healthy but who engage in unhealthy behavior or have risk factors. Above them, a smaller group are people who have diseases but are not seeking treatment. And then finally, at the top of the pyramid, a small group of about 5% of people are sick and being treated for their sickness. Now look at how we spend money. Our health budget goes to those who are sick and seek care. 95% of our budget goes there. And the other bit, the healthy people and making sure they remain healthy, the ones who are at potential risk, We spend nothing on them. And that is a misuse of our money. We need to balance that. And how do we balance that? Well, the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization says the cost of implementing best buy measures to prevent and treat NCDs in low-income countries is $1.20 per person per year. The cost of not acting will be about $25 per person a year and millions of deaths. Not in the next 50 or the next 60 years, but in the next 15 years. Finally, in Thailand, they take a 2% levy on tobacco and alcohol and use it for a health promotion foundation called Thai Health. These are the results from Thai Health. This has also been done in Australia, Austria, and several other countries. But I choose Thailand because they are similar to us. In Thailand, a 2% levy given to health promotion has produced a 400% increase in ex-smokers between 2000 and 2009. A 12% drop in alcohol use between 2004 and 2007. A 31% drop in traffic accidents between 2004 and 2009. A 10% drop in numbers of deaths through road accidents. Investing money in prevention makes sense. It's sensible. I am now finished. For me, the tax is a win-win-win. It's a win because it is the most effective method to reduce consumption. Certainly for tobacco, that's true. It increases government revenues. And if the funds are used to promote health and replace the public harm with the public benefit, we all benefit. Thank you very much.
Apologies, I'm just trying to get my talk ready. Sorry, apologies for that. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present here on behalf of the South African Pediatric Association. I'm Dr. Zamperli. I am a pediatrician at Red Cross Children's Hospital at the University of Cape Town. And I want you to just, given the discussion earlier, we were not privy to any of previous meetings, and we were only given notice 2 days ago to invited to attend, so I apologize that you might hear a repetition of the science, but I'm here representing a group of pediatricians and our view on the matter. So just to give you who we are, tell you we are a non-profit organization. We represent over 1,000 pediatricians who are the custodians of children's health in the country. Our mission is to promote and advance pediatrics and child health in South Africa. And the way we do that is promote optimal health, growth, and development of all children. We advocate against deleterious environmental and social influences that may act to the detriment of children. And we also promote comprehensive approach to pediatric practice, the emphasis on prevention of diseases and health promotion. So I'm coming as a clinician, as a pediatrician, and from the coalface, and just to give, bring you to light, to light what it is that we face at the coalface with this epidemic. Here is a case example of a young boy, 8 years old, presented last year, suffering with breathing problems at night. He was referred to Children's Hospital for further tests. We identified health problems. He weighed 86 kilos, morbid obese. He had high blood pressure. He was bedwetting every night. He had life-threatening sleep apnea. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's severe snoring with asphyxiation at night, which was already putting strain on his heart muscle. This is just a test to show you the oxygen levels at night. Those circled areas show the oxygen levels drop to near fatal levels, where the heart would almost come to a standstill. And that's the equivalent of asphyxiating every night in your bed. He was admitted to the emergency intensive care for 3 days, attached to life support equipment to sustain breathing, heart function, started on blood pressure medications, heart medications. A whole battery of health screening tests were done to look for causes. The only thing we could find is terrible diet in the family, not only sugary drinks, but very importantly, in this particular case, this boy drank 2 liters of fizzy sugary drink every day. When you ask the question why, it tasted good and it was cheap. So the long-term interventions and costs for this is the blood pressure and health medications. Remember, this is an 8-year-old child. Dietary interventions, the medical costs are huge. Important to note for Treasury, these are the costs that we are trying to prevent. He was put on a sleep apnea breathing machine, which cost 50,000 Rand, which, by the way, had to go as a donation because our government won't buy them because obesity is considered a lifestyle disease. So all of this is preventable. So I'm going to quickly go through the facts because I believe the hearing has heard the facts that we know that childhood obesity and its related complications are on the rise, and you've seen some data presented earlier. South Africa has one of the highest rates in the world of sugary drink consumptions amongst 9 and 10-year-olds. And this data looks to compare to see how many average sugary drinks children drink per week, and you see I've highlighted there South Africa is just leading behind the United States. We know obesity affects more poor communities, so the sugarcane farmers' children that the committee are so concerned about are the ones that are going to be most affected by this obesity epidemic, not the rich children or the privileged children. And it's, you can see data, and it affects children in urban areas as well as poor rural areas. And this is data from Mpumalanga comparing to Soweto. You've seen also data that the rate of obesity in children, this is data from Soweto, across children across all age, where young women at the age of 20, almost just under half, are considered overweight or obese. Just some more facts, and I think it's important to stress that obesity starts in childhood. 70% of obese children, adolescents, will be obese adults. Those are adults who are meant to contribute to the economy of the country, to contribute financially. The reduction of sugary beverage consumption will reduce childhood and adult obesity, and there's plenty of data out there to show that. Given the opportunity, we can present it. Taxation of 20% increase in price is predicted to alter consumer behavior and reduction, and there is data out there to show that, if the committee wish to see that. Malnourished, important point to make, to point out, is that malnourished children, which is a high prevalence in our poor communities, are at higher risk of becoming obese in later life. There's a good correlation with if you're malnourished as a child, you're going to be obese as an adult. And it's to do with behavioral, in the way children are fed, the types of food children are fed at a very young age, changes the metabolic physiology of people, which puts them at risk of obesity in adulthood. And of course, we know non-communicable diseases. You've heard about the presentation about the impact, the cost impact of diabetes, and this is a projection in South Africa on the projected cost just on diabetes to increase from 14 to 26 billion in 2030. So, and of course, there are also predictions, and I'm going to bore you with the figures, but of what in South African children, what we are facing, the epidemic. So I want to just state the CARPA's position, the Pediatric Association, that first of all we applaud National Treasury's introduction on a policy to tax sugar-sweetened drinks. The government has a duty of care and a constitutional obligation to promote the attainment of optimal health, and the sugary drink tax will assist in achieving it. We also believe the policy can be strengthened and to make it even more effective. So we've come up with a few recommendations from our point. We support the institution of the highest tax of 20%. There are studies, international studies, which have looked at this. The 20% increase in sugar-sweetened beverages is required to have significant impact on purchases, consumptions, and ultimately obesity. So compromises, we agree, compromises, we do not support any compromises in this. Tax should be for all sugar and all sugary drinks, and we do not support the exemption of the first 4 grams in the first 100 ml. There is no evidence that the benefits of this step will incentivize manufacturers to reduce the sugar content of some drinks. Indeed, allowing this exemption will threaten health promotion efforts favoring consumption of zero sugar, sugar beverages, best of which is water. Thirdly, we support the increase the tax rate to concentrates to the same rate as ready-to-drink products. Failure to do this promotes a switch to cheap sugary concentrates, such as squashes, syrups, which defeats the entire object of the policy, which is to reduce all drinkable sugars. We foresee tax all drinks with added sugar, fruit juices, dairy-based products with naturally derived caloric sweeteners in whatever form, including high fructose corn syrup and fruit juice, may contain equal or higher levels of sugar than carbonated soft drinks. The sugar contained in sweeteners have similar metabolic effects and are as harmful as any other sugar, and there's no logical reason to tax them similarly, not to tax them similarly. And lastly, the revenue generated from sugary drinks tax could be directed to promote and improve child health and early childhood development. The prevalence of malnutrition is still unacceptably high in South Africa and exposes these children to higher risks and increased mortality. And as I mentioned before, it's the poor children who are at greatest risk. Health education programs are lacking, and certainly these fund revenues could be directed towards promoting early childhood nutrition and needed. So in conclusion, the South African government must put the health of South Africa's children before special interests who target children with their unhealthy products. The South African Pediatric Association pledges its support to Treasury efforts and is committed to supporting promulgation of this policy. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. I hope you have not been lucky to have 5 more minutes because the chair who happens to be the timekeeper was not here at the time. That was on a lighter note. We have agreed between myself and him that he will chair the whole session, because I'm still, I was not here in the first public hearing, so I'm still trying to get to understand exactly where I'm going to and listen attentively to the presentation. According to the agenda in handing over to him, now we are in discussions, honorable members, which I do think now it is your turn to raise issues that you wanted to raise in relation to the presentations that were have been presented to us in line with what then the Honorable Karim has suggested during the first session of our presentations. I'll hand over to you, Mr. Karim. There is a gentleman who's raising his hand. I don't know whether you want to speak before the discussions. Honorable Karim, over to you.
Good morning, Chair. Are we in discussion mode now?
Yeah.
A comment more than...
Hang on, sir. Just 1 second. Who would you be?
Sorry. My name is Suresh Naidu, and I'm from the South African Sugar Association.
Yeah, I know. You'll get a chance to speak. We'll encourage some dialogue between yourselves and the... NGOs and the academics who support an HPL.
Sure.
But right now...
I just wanted to make a comment on some of the aspects that were spoken about
Well, I understand. Process. You're getting a chance to speak. Is that not right in the next session?
I will, but yeah. I want to comment specifically on a...
No, well, I encourage that, but you see, it's not fair, because then what's going to happen is they're going to want to reply, and so on. You have to abide by the norms. This committee is unusually consultative. You will be allowed to speak. And we'll also allow you to engage in dialogue. And we would encourage you to have dialogue outside the committee system as well. Go and meet in Swane or wherever and try to strike some consensus. But we have to go by the rules. Because if we're unfair to you, unfair to others, if we allowed you to respond to them now, then they'll have to respond to you. When will the members of parliament ask their questions? But you'll get a chance. Okay, thank you very much. Right, can we hand over to members? So in this order that you seem to be, it's Pinky, and I can't see the hand. Is that Wilmot? And then coming down the other way, is I can't see who that is. Is that Sam, Matthias? Yeah. And then it's Imam Sheikh, and then it's Fish, obviously, and then the comrade and Pinky. Peace, yeah. Is that Yazid? Okay. Peace Mabe, are you back? Are you in the Finance Committee now?
Officially, yes.
Yeah, officially welcome to the Finance Committee.
Thank you very much.
Right, so... Let's then start with the, in the order that we raise it. All members speak up to 3 minutes, right, to be fair.
I think, Chair, between this public hearing and the past public hearing, I share the same sentiment with you on the level of presentations and other things that have been made. My worry, though, is that we are doing all these engagements, but we are leaving the ordinary people on the ground. I'm not sure whether there is a high level of awareness and advocacy with our people on what we think the Department of Health is looking at in terms of their health issues and what Treasury has to look at. It's something that I want us to note. And Chair, my appeal to the Department of Health is that, look, sugar is but one of the issues, the things that contributes towards obesity. And it is not only sugar that we drink in sodas, but it's sugar in many things, chocolates, cakes and everything. And there must be an approach by the Department of Health to say, going forward, this is our broader plan to deal with the issues that confront our people in as far as health is concerned. And amongst other things, it's a healthy lifestyle. I mean, seated here and as being a former councillor, the relationship between the Department of Health and SAGA becomes very paramount now to say the department must start to approach municipalities and say, in your parks, in your whatever, let's prioritize gyms and all these things, like what the mayor of Soweto, the former mayor, not the current mayor, the former mayor, Comrade Dow, did in Soweto, putting the gyms all over and making sure, so the DA can say it's their own making. So they must look at those things and partner along some of those things. And I agree with one presenter who was saying, given all these numbers and the number of people who are dying or who are affected by type 2 diabetes, what is our target as the Department of Health to reduce this obesity thing? Do we have a target that we are working on, and what is the plan to go towards that thing? And Chair, to Treasury, I want to see, Treasury, I know we have our priorities also for government to get revenue to implement our programs, but it can't be revenue at the expense of our people. What are the unintended consequences that this will bring? Not long we came with the AGOA thing, our people were out of jobs, and women for that matter are the ones who are working in this farming area. Not long, I'm telling you, we met the Tongat people, the landlaymen who received, who are who are funded by SIFA 2 weeks ago. And they are saying, these people who are off-takers of sugar cane to the milling and to all these beverages.
I think you're at 3 minutes, but you'll have some latitude, yeah.
They are saying, I'm speaking on behalf of the Keledi as well, who's not here, and Tandi. They are saying, ask his chair, I'm sorry, I'm just pulling your leg. They are saying, these off-takers are now saying, we'll go next door, which is Swaziland, and Swaziland is our neighbor. We are not even xenophobic about it. They also have to benefit on some of these things. But they are saying, we are going next door, sugar is cheaper, we'll leave you. What does it mean to us? And that radical economic transformation that the chair spoke to. So these are some of the things that are starting to creep in. And what are we saying to our people? You must first go and talk to energy. And energy must say, over and above this sugarcane, we'll do biofuels and all these things so that we can even expand on the growing of sugarcane before we start to talk about the taxation and other things, so that our people are also guaranteed that they too will become commercial farmers.
Okay, I'm sorry, because then it's not fair to others, right?
Thank you, Chair.
It's two committees and we have to be ruthless. I'll also take not more than 3 minutes. You can time me on your stopwatch. Okay, that's it. Attitude there, but not, well, Wilmot will insist on 4 minutes. All right, look, let's be fair. Everybody's got up to 4 minutes. That means we stay here longer.
Mr. Chair, I'll just use 1 minute. I just have two questions for Treasury. The first is to do with what you've introduced here, the graduated tax, which is what they propose in the UK. And the whole idea about the graduated tax is you want to encourage companies to innovate, to bring them below the threshold so that there are no additional taxes. So I just want to know what the evidence is in terms of the structure you propose, and is it designed to have that outcome, and what's the evidence for that? So that's the first question. The second has to do with the fact that a tax raises the revenue. What we're concerned about is how you spend that revenue. We want to spend that revenue to promote health, which means you need to fund a health body. We don't support ring fencing. We understand where that comes from, but the fact is we can't just have the word of the Minister of Health that the money will be spent to give the Medical Research Council 10 million rand a year to run a longitudinal study to gather some real evidence about whether the tax as proposed has behavioral consequences and not some mathematical modeling is based on some desktop research. So my question, those are my two questions.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm a bit worried about us sort of expressing views while we're listening to the arguments and sort of already reaching conclusions, because I have
Hearings before. But
yeah, but now you're having further hearings, then that begs the question, why are we having further hearings?
Given the discussions we're having, it's two committees and we have to deal with this matter.
Yeah.
If there's a better system, Derek, you're welcome to present it.
No. All I'm saying is that even if you have had a hearing, we're listening to arguments once again. And at the end of listening to all of the arguments, we have to deliberate and come to some kind of a conclusion as committee or joint committees. That's the reality. We have to come to some kind of conclusion. We probably have divergent views over here, but we have to take into account all of the arguments, the strength of the arguments, and come to a decision. I'm a bit worried about us saying, well, I support a tax or I don't support a tax now at this stage of proceedings. Just a couple of points, though. I think bottom line is that we don't need to debate it. We need to introduce measures, we have to reduce sugar intake. And the evidence is compelling in that regard. Nobody would argue otherwise, that there has to be measures. We have to deal with this as a health problem and find the appropriate interventions to deal with this. It's an imperative. The question then is it's also a sort of a no-brainer that increased price, and the arguments have been made, would contribute towards reduced consumption combined with other measures. Okay. So the real concern would be, as expressed by Pinky, would be in the event that there is reduced consumption, what effect would it have on the industry? How many job losses? Just for consideration, that's what the real issue is. At the end of the day, you know, the real concern about the introduction of this tax. Something to consider obviously we need to be, you know, a little bit more assured of the modeling and the extent to which job losses will follow. But should we not consider how one can use this levy in the event of it being approved and introduced, how one could use this levy not just for further research, but for mitigating the effects of possible job losses? Because that's what the concern is, that clearly, I mean, there's a poverty issue here, there are people that are dying that at early death, there's an economic effect, we know those arguments, economic effects of diabetes, but there are some immediate possibilities of immediate job losses. I think if one were able to mitigate the possible impact on the industry and job losses through the application of this levy, that might go a long way towards people accepting that this levy, that negative, as Pinky called it, unintended consequence, but inevitable consequence of the introduction of a levy, or possible inevitable consequence, as will be argued, no doubt, that there are ways of mitigating it by the application of this levy.
Well, thanks, Honourable Chair. Look, the science here and the statistics are too graphic for one to ignore. The long-term economic and social consequences of failure to step up the fight against proliferation, of sweetening and allowing sugar into our staple food and food products. So it's important that we have to check one another's bona fide here. Look, the DA and the ANC have to be very clear. They are representative here. Where do they stand on this? Do they stand on the side of the poor who consumes on daily basis these foodstuffs? We have to, our bona fides must be very clear here. On whose side do you stand? Because there's no point of us having this conversation with people who were expected to enforce government regulations. They are at the same time the defenders of the multinationals and their business. And one speaker here said that we need to look at science and predict the future. And we should be doing so with people that we can trust. Look, I agree also with the proposal that we must propose that tax rate must be pegged at about 20. I suggest we can even peg it at 30%. And ensure that we minimize sweetening and sugar ingredients in our foodstuff. Government must consider to ban GMOs and must also consider to ban dangerous and toxic substances in our foodstuffs. I also agree with the equation that has been presented here of the tobacco, chronic diseases, poverty and obesity. Poor people have got no choice but to eat anything that comes their way, for as long as it relieves the poverty and will lessen their impoverishment. So, and agree that these are people that must be protected by government. And we can only do so if we step up the fight and ensure that the regulations are tightened and are enforced. I doubt if the state has the capacity to enforce all what we are discussing here, let alone the conflicted interest of our colleagues from the ANC and the DA seated here.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me also reiterate the point that I think the statistics here by our experts speaks volumes of the challenges that we face, not in South Africa alone, but in the other continents. But let me also start off by expressing my disappointment, Chair. For decades, all the industry, the beverage industry, were interested in were profits and profits and profits at the expense of the poorest of the poor. In fact, if I want to be blunt, I would rather say that they've been drinking the blood of the poorest of the poor, and that is what they've been doing. You know, Chair, they've made no effort whatsoever to even, in terms of the products, do some advertising, showing the harmful effects. They've never done all those things. Now, suddenly, they are running in circles because they believe we want it again. What is the reason that we want to put up this tax? Only because our people are dying, our people are suffering. That is the reason. Because we care about our people while you care about profits. Now, I know what business will do. No business is going to close down. You're telling me Coca-Cola is going to close down? You are going to go and introduce other products because your business is money, profits, that's it. So if you're going to reduce the sugar content, and that's what you should be talking about, how can we also try to reduce the sugar content rather than just opposing the issue of the tax? The purpose of the tax is twofold. One is to reduce consumption, but also to use that revenue to be able to educate our people in terms of the health hazards of these things. So I think we must not forget that. Chair, there is no evidence, and I think the experts have also shown us this, in terms of job losses. They are saying, an example is the tobacco industry, that there were no job losses. In fact, on the other hand, they say there were jobs created. But at the same time, there are other jobs that will be created. Now, I'll give you an example. If we talk about farming, if there's a problem with one product, then you can go and grow another product. But we need to innovate, like I'm asking Coca-Cola and everybody else to innovate. Farm workers can also innovate, because we are concerned about our farm workers as well. Another chairperson, the other problem that I got is, I personally, we don't believe that you should reduce it from that 20%. All those beverages should be taxed. There should be no exemption whatsoever. Absolutely nothing. Because at the end of the day, if you look at the statistics as to what is going on, Chair, I know a child from 5 years old is diabetic, from 5 years old. He injects himself 5 times, 6 times a day. Chair, you need to know and understand how many people are walking around with their legs amputated. How many people in this country are blind. And the challenge is kidney failure. The minister has said clearly, he can put a dialysis machine in every hospital. Is that the solution? We don't want our people to die. So let us also take that into consideration rather than just concentrating on profits and nothing else. Chair, I think what is very, very important here, it is that we need to put the poorest of the poor who are affected the most. That is what we need to do. And I want to tell you, Chair, from the presentations that I had today, and I'm going to conclude there, if industry still wants to insist and promote and push to want to oppose this tax after what you have seen there, then it is clearly your interest is only about profits and nothing else. And that for me is very disappointing. I'll stop there.
Sam, when are you going to recruit Sheikh Imam into the EFF? He's more radical in his words than you are. He's too radical for the Communist Party, Sam. So you better take it. Okay. Over then to who's next? Here's my brother. It's Fish, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No. Thanks. Well, firstly, I want to share the same sentiments with Honorable Anikom. Well, my own understanding is that it's a public hearing. And as members, we have not arrived at a stage where we should express our views and our positions on this matter. My understanding is that we are here to listen, arising from that, raise clarity seeking questions. And then at a later stage, we'll then have to engage into a discussion and present our argument and our views. And that's what I thought is the purpose of this. But we seem to be moving away from that. And that's my concern, Chair, because if we must start then presenting our own views on this matter, we'll be all over. And therefore, we're not going to be able, therefore, to have the benefit of engaging those that we have invited to come and make a presentation so that we have got an understanding of their position on these matters. But that's my plea, Chair, that if it's practical possible, we must try it as much as we possibly can to avoid that. to put our own position on these matters, because we do have positions on these issues. So let me not then be tempted to also raise my position, because I do have a very strong view and very strong position on these issues. Which position some of them might not be the same as the position from the same political party that we come from. But I don't want to go there, you see. I don't want to go there. I'm implying that I don't want to go there.
Fish, can I
then
just
let me raise three questions.
Oh, you'll raise issues, okay.
Yeah. Let me raise three questions, sir. One issue is that, firstly, to Treasure, I was looking at various presentations that are still going to come as well. There is a strong view that there's never been, this matter has not been adequately canvassed at NEDLAC. I heard you saying that, you know, you did engage at NEDLAC, but it was not very clear what final was the product of that engagement at NEDLAC. You didn't express clearly that. And if you can just go into details, how have you concluded that matter at NEDLAC so that we have got a better understanding? Well, there is some argument around this area. And then secondly, just to have an understanding, to what extent will this, in the same context, not exactly what Honorable James has said, will this revenue be utilized to promote a healthy lifestyle? So that we don't engage into an exercise that we are engaging it with the sole purpose of not addressing the challenge that we're confronted with, but it is part of a process of Treasurer to raise funds, and not for the main intended purpose of why are we engaging in this exercise. I'm raising this in the context that what is therefore the justice, if that is the understanding that we are dealing with this matter because we want to address this issue of non-communicable diseases, it's a crisis. If that is the understanding, what is the rationale therefore not to institute a 20% tax? Because the studies that has been Dan suggests that the only impact that you are going to realize if you intrude a tax, it can only start to be having an impact at the 20%. Anything below that will not have an impact. So why then introduce something that's not going to have an impact at the end of the day? Thanks very much.
I should clarify this. I think there seems to be much some misunderstanding, especially for civil society. Firstly, the majority party has come to no position. It's also understandable, as we've said in finance, that there's nothing in the African claims or the Freedom Charter or in any of the ANC documents on a health promotion levy. It would be understandable if there are differences of views within each party, let alone. That's not a problem. There are no positions here. We also said we're not plunging into making any decisions. So I don't see a problem in people raising questions that imply their positions for now. There's no harm in that. We're a broad national movement. We're not a narrow political party, the ANC. So, you know, even the peasants in Mongolia know their differences, as inevitably they will be on this position. But I think that should be separated from the role of a chairperson, which is to facilitate. And given that we had two sets of public hearings, which unfortunately almost a third of the participants now were not present at, the job of a chair, and you can always rule the chair out, especially this chair, I'm pretty cool about it. You can just put your hand up and say as a majority, we don't agree with you. I had said to the academic experts that you're experts in health, and I think you've convinced most of us. Our chairman was very clear. I even said personally, I didn't take a position.
But I do have a very strong position, but I'm chairing it. So the idea was to facilitate. Each of us can't get stuck in our respective pigeonholes, as it were. We have to look at what the other parties are saying so that we can at least arrive at some measure of consensus. It might be necessary for us to come again. Once we've had the public hearing, not have a public hearing, but to come with a paper. I've been thinking about these things, but I haven't spoken to you, Lindella or Fish. And then we have a workshop and say, this is what the committee feels and so on. So we, each of us gives and takes. So let me please communicate that if you are unhappy, comrades, colleagues, with the chairing and presenting some point, please feel free to say, no, Chairperson, we think it's too preemptive, it's steering people in a particular direction with your unconscious biases. I'm very happy. Please do that. We've done it in the Finance Committee. I get told off regularly. Nothing stops Health Committee members to tell me off. Right? Oh, Tandi is not here, but she's the one. That... So please, comrades who are from the Health, if you're unhappy with anything I say, say so. So please understand that one is a facilitation role in order to avoid covering the same ground. The other is that they will invariably be different. It's a complex matter. And I think it's very good that each party has differences of point of view at this stage. It's too complex to arrive at some simple conclusion. So we're all finding our way. So anything a member says from at least a majority party, I can say, there is no final position on the matter. And we will debate and engage, and we have our structures in Parliament, you might know, colleagues from civil society, called study groups, where we will discuss these things. So there's no final position. Fish, you are right. Derek is right. But I was trying in my interview, Derek, I withdraw what I said. What I was trying to say is that's a facilitation role, and maybe I shouldn't have said it, in which case, do whatever you want to do, say whatever you want to say. I had tried to avoid it, Derek. I thought between myself and Ndelwa we'll draft like the terms of reference. So to avoid that, we did it. But anyway, please, feel free to tell the chair to jump in the lake. I'm happy with that. Fine, Doctor.
Thank you, Chair. That's good. But we